all right, so now it start like it's instantly the happy rest of the chapter. Like, now that evil's defeated, now I agree with you that this is the biggest celebration. Okay, yeah.
I'll admit, even though the last bit was kind of dark because they're thinking about the end of the world, like the Lord of the Rings equivalent of the atomic bomb going off.
Yeah.
I think the focus of the chapter is still like the building love between Eowyn and Faramir, and this is now.
Yeah, and we don't have the suspense because we already know the Gurgis already celebrated.
right.
Like, all together, you know, but.
Right. But yeah, totally agreed. Now is the time for full exaltation.
Right. And this is also when the big evil's defeated, this totally turns into.
Chapter 5 of Book 6, the second chapter of Ending? No.
I mean, dude, I was blindsided how big this chapter was. I was not prepared for this. The past two chapters were massive. I thought this one we at least start to get, you know, like the fallout. No, this one was... I don't know. I don't know. It was really big. It was feelings. What'd you think? Was it too big? Yes, is my answer. There's a lot going on. It starts really dark, kind of.
Yeah.
I guess not really, but yeah.
It's the first fully celebratory chapter, I would say. It feels like
is it even fully? I don't know. Dude, they're...
Okay.
The first part.
I feel like it's the first chapter that you could say is like a celebration. There's so many other moments.
Oh, well, last chapter was a celebration.
Okay. Maybe we had different feelings about it. But to me, this felt like, I don't know, like a feast day or something. Like it's just like this signature moment. The last one was like the climax of the battle and all the action. But this is like this is like everyone getting together for a giant feast to commemorate it. Not in like a happy, we're having a party type of way. More a little bit more somber than that, but it's like this is like the sigh of relief after the last chapter.
Okay. I don't know if I fully agree with that, because the first thing we're going to talk about, Eowyn and Faramir, I mean, that's like a week living in impending doom. so I kind of disagree there, but we'll get to it. And then obviously, I know I haven't done this in probably like three Lord of the Rings books, but just topics for tonight. Eowyn and Faramir, coronation play-by-play. We got to talk about that Gandalf and Aragorn scene up on the mountain. And then we're going to add on a deleted scene. What's basically a deleted scene of basically two conversations that Tolkien had written stuff about that would have probably taken place in Minas Tirith or are good to reveal now, because they kind of serve as almost tell-alls for some parts of these books that, you know, people are always just wondering about, or might have been wondering about, or should at some point wonder about if they thought about it a lot. I don't know. So anyways, we're going to get into all that, but yeah, Cliff's notes first. What do you got?
Well, you touched on a lot of them there, but to be explicit, this is the Steward and the King. So... Eowyn and Faramir cross paths in the House of Healing and slowly fall in love. Aragorn and the Army of the West return to Gondor, and Aragorn is crowned king. The Third Age comes to an end. Sounds simple. That's it? Sounds simple.
I thought that. All right. Well, you you didn't let on a certain ending that happens at this chapter, at end of this chapter. I guess we'll have to get there.
We will have to get there.
Okay. So let me see. All right, what do we got? Seriously, the span of this chapter goes from about March 17th to June 30th. Okay, so that's like 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And the fellowship from Rivendell to Mount Doom took 3 months. So
arguably, so this is a lot. Is a huge amount of plot that happens here in the course of even a few paragraphs, right?
Right. So, I mean, we have to recalibrate, I don't know, how we digest everything that goes on, because mm-hmm. this is such a bigger time scale that they just start whipping through. But anyways, it starts back in time. Aragorn's army had just set out, so Minas Tirith is anxiously waiting to hear any news of Doom that's going to come up, as all the brave heroes that are not completely injured go out to war, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the chief people left behind, obviously it's Eowyn. She wants to talk to who's ever in charge of the city, which at this point is Faramir, who's also recovering in the House of the Healing, right? So I wasn't too sure what to make of Eowyn and Faramir's first meeting. I don't really want to read it because there's so much to talk about tonight.
Mm-hmm.
But did you have any takeaways?
So it's important to note, even though Faramir's in charge of the city, they're both still in healing. Basically, doctor's orders, bed rest.
Yep.
The doctor happened to be Aragorn, but that's kind of, we don't go into that in too much detail.
Well, there's another doctor. There's like the, right. you know,
the hospital some no-name warden. Guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
it seems like Faramir falls for Eowyn pretty quickly, or at least is like, wow, this is one of the most beautiful people I've ever seen. Eowyn is totally under a storm cloud and is clearly thinking about Aragorn, which it seems like Faramir picks up on pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And there's a few lines about how Faramir is basically the type of he's very empathetic. He's sensitive to pity and passion, and he sees Eowyn's grief immediately, and it kind of makes him love her all the more.
Right. The line is Eowyn, Faramir seeing her, her loveliness amid her grief would pierce his heart. Mm. And then Eowyn conversely sees in Eomir a very great warrior. Here was one whom no rider of the mark could outmatch in battle, which I thought was a little weird, because if I had Eomir versus Faramir in a fight, I would be betting on Eomir. Not gonna lie.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we haven't heard many descriptions of Faramir battling, right? Other than a totally odds against him battling against the orcs and the Nazgul.
Well, there was the elephants too with Frodo and Sam.
Right.
That they killed. And right. he was actually a baller there. They just were describing it from afar, though. But, right. yeah. I don't know how Eowyn can tell a warrior that's just sitting up in a hospital, though. But whatever. I'll go with it, I guess. But, yeah. The other, I think, important thing is that both are feeling the grief of being kind of prisoners, just awaiting to see what happens, you know, because mm-hmm. they can't help out in this battle, and they just got to sit through it and just wait, right? I also thought, too, this was a missed opportunity that I never did it. We should have talked about Eowyn as kind of like Joan of Arc, you know?
Definitely.
Because, I don't know, we could have gone somewhere with that. Anyways, missed opportunity. We have all sorts of missed opportunities on this show, but that's that. let's see. What'd you think of Faramir's like very straightforwardness, even in this very first conversation? Because basically he says, you know, you're welcome to walk around the garden with me too, you know, and it would ease my care. And Eowyn's like, oh, why would that ease your care? That's the line they kept using. Mm-hmm. Do you want to read his response? I thought it was pretty good.
Sure. Eowyn of Rohan, I say to you that you are beautiful. In the valleys of our hills there are flowers fair and bright, and maidens fairer still, but neither flower nor lady have I seen till now in Gondor so lovely and so sorrowful. It may be that only a few days are left ere darkness falls upon our world, and when it comes I hope to face it steadily, but it would ease my heart if, while yet the sun shines, I could see you still. For you and I have both passed under the wings of the shadow, and the same hand drew us back.
Alas, not me, Lord, she said. Shadows lie on me still. Look not to me for healing. I am a shield maiden, and my hand is ungentle. But I thank you for this at least, that I need not keep to my chamber. I will walk abroad by the grace of the steward of the city. and she did him a courtesy and walked back to the house. But Faramir for a long while walked alone in the garden, and his glance now strayed rather to the house than the eastward walls. All right. So where did we last leave off with Eowyn? Do you remember?
Well, we saw her briefly, kind of while she was a little bit unconscious, while Aragorn was sweeping in under the cover of night to heal Faramir, Merry, and Eowyn all together, right? All of whom had been basically almost mortally wounded by the Nazgul, by the...
Yeah, but like, what conclusion do we come to that? Because, you know, we remember Eowyn's whole character, like, she seemed to have the hots for Aragorn, basically. hinted at throughout the chapters, but then Aragorn, when he was healing her, was like, yeah, I can't really be here when I wake up, because she shouldn't see me, because I can't return the love, basically.
Right.
Do you remember more about that with Eowyn?
So,
like, he healed her body, but he didn't, you know, he couldn't heal her heart.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. You know? I think, yeah, I can't remember the line, but it was something basically like her body might not be broken, but her heart still will be, or something.
Yeah, she needs some sort of help or healing that he can't give her. So
yeah,
that's where we really left off with her, because, like, mm-hmm. you know, everybody likes Eowyn because she's kind of the woman holding her own and like kind of a man's world, I guess, you know, probably 90% of the Lord of the Rings characters are men, right? Mm-hmm. But then also part of the reason that it was like good for her that she did end up going to war, we think, is because she was kind of cooped up in Rohan stuck with Wormtongue, and then Théoden when he was like a curmudgeon old man, you know, under the spell, basically. And so she also needed to be liberated, just like Théoden, to like get out of there, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and actually, I don't know. She had warrior aspirations as well, I guess, kind of came to, or to valiantly fight for her people. And mm-hmm. so now it seems like she's really still gung-ho to go, even though she's injured, because she wants to valiantly die now, I think is what I was kind of coming to the conclusion about after reading this first conversation.
Right. It's pretty morbid. Disagree? Agreed.
Yeah.
She is kind of saying, I have nothing left to live for, and I want to die in a honorable martyr type of fashion, and Faramir pretty much talks her down from that.
She already feels what Aragorn said, you know, so Aragorn mm-hmm. predicted it basically dead on, as usual with Aragorn, right? but so anyways, yeah, she doesn't think she's gonna find, I don't know, any the full heart healing, right? So it's like, well, I might as well just die valiantly defending my people, or with my people, or for my people, you know. The other interesting thing is too, Faramir is a 100% beloved character by all Tolkien fans too.
Mm-hmm.
Tolkien basically said, this is me inserting myself into the story in a guy that's much braver than me, right? And if you remember all the Back to Our Two Towers episodes, he didn't even expect Faramir. He just kind of walked into the story, you know, like he was definitely one of those things that he really just discovered, as opposed to invented himself. That was like a common theme ever since like The Hobbit, right? And so the reason everyone loves Faramir is because it was pretty highly stressed, especially in Two Towers, but basically all his actions, even dealing with Denethor, is that he's definitely peaceful by nature, hates war, and he only fights evil to defend good things, right? He's got mm-hmm. that I love not the sword quote, I only love what it defends, you know? So it's kind of funny, because that seems like Faramir and Eowyn potentially have like clashing personalities, you know, which is kind of weird, because both characters are pretty universally beloved throughout by all Tolkien fans, you know.
Yeah, I get one interesting thing is that they're both different from their parents, or they seem like they're a little bit of the odd one out in their families in a way.
Yeah, right? Potentially. Yeah,
or there's like an element of like they were constrained in some way and kind of had to break free and come into their own in the last two books or so.
Yeah. Well, so okay, yeah. All right. So anyways, after this conversation, Faramir basically learns everything he can about Eowyn, either from the doctor or from Merry, because Merry's still mm-hmm. there, right? Which is kind of funny, because he knew Pippin, and now he knows, I don't know, I guess he got to know Merry a little bit. But then there's that next, you want to take that next paragraph that I said there on 940?
As Faramir came from the houses, he saw her, as she stood upon the walls, and she was clad all in white and gleamed in the sun. And he called to her, and she came down, and they walked on the grass or sat under a tree together, now in silence, now in speech. And each day after they did likewise. And the warden, looking from his window, was glad in heart, for he was a healer, and his care was lightened. And certain it was that heavy as was the dread and foreboding of those days upon the hearts of men, still these two of his charges prospered and grew daily in strength.
All right. Thoughts, feelings on that?
Well, it seems like they're falling in love, but short of love, they're at least developing a relationship, whether it's platonic or romantic, that's reinforcing both of them.
Yeah.
Totally well, dark I mean, the, time.
Yeah. I mean, the warden's saying, you know, he's a healer doctor and he's seeing both of them get better. So,
right. Right.
You know,
clear evidence.
Right. Potentially, this is the healing source that Aragorn was predicting Eowyn needed. We'll see.
Right. Absolutely. I think it is important to remember here, though, it's confusing because the last chapter, we know the ring was destroyed. At this point in this chapter, the ring is not yet destroyed, right?
Right,
like they
right.
do think that the world is going to end and mm-hmm. everything is really terrible. And so that's the background, the literal background for this setting of, like, you know, slowly falling in love. They think these are their last days potentially.
Right. Right. All right. So there's 5 days in a row of this impending doom, but then also just hanging out in the garden. Right. Still no mm-hmm. news from the army. And then Faramir, he gives Eowyn a cool-sounding blue robe that was his mom's before she died. And then Eowyn's now extremely nervous because they've been waiting a full week at this point with no word whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads to the crux section of this... the crux passage of this section, I guess. And it's... I don't know, it's big, but it's... We can't pass it up. There's too much going mm-hmm. on to not read it. So we got to jump into it. I don't know. Let's try to save like main conversation for after it. But if you got any like tidbits, just throw it in whenever you see it. Maybe I'll start us off. Oh, no. You'll start us off because you're more like Faramir. I guess I'm more like Eowyn, but whatever.
<Okay. laughs> 7 days, said Faramir. But think not ill of me if I say to you, they brought me both a joy and a pain that I never thought to know. Joy to see you, but pain, because now the fear and doubt of this evil time are grown dark indeed. Eowyn, I would not have this world end now, or lose so soon what I have found.
Lose what you have found, lord, she answered, but she looked at him gravely, and her eyes were kind. I know not what in these days you have found that you could lose. But come, my friend, let us not speak of it. Let us not speak at all. I stand upon some dreadful brink, and it is utterly dark in the abyss before my feet. But whether there is any light behind me, I cannot tell. For I cannot turn yet. I wait for some stroke of doom.
Yes, we wait for the stroke of doom, said Faramir. And they said no more, and it seemed to them as they stood upon the wall that the wind died and the light failed, and the sun was bleared, and all sounds in the city or in the lands about were hushed. Neither wind nor voice nor bird call nor rustle of leaf nor their own breath could be heard. The very beating of their hearts was stilled. Time halted. And as they stood so, their hands met and clasped, though they did not know it. And still they waited for they knew not what. Then presently it seemed to them that above the ridges of the distant mountains another vast mountain of darkness rose, towering up like a wave that should engulf the world, and about it lightnings flickered, and then a tremor ran through the earth, and they felt the walls of the city quiver. A sound like a sigh went up from all the lands about them, and their hearts beat suddenly again. It reminds me of Numenor, said Faramir, and wondered to hear himself speak.
Of Numenor, said Eowyn.
Yes, said Faramir, of the land of Westernness that foundered, and of the great dark wave climbing over the green lands and above the hills, and coming on, darkness unescapable. I often dream of it.
Then you think the darkness is coming, said Eowyn. Darkness unescapable? And suddenly she drew close to him.
No, said Faramir, looking into her face. It was but a picture in the mind. I do not know what is happening. The reason of my waking mind tells me the great evil has befallen, and we stand at the end of days. My heart says nay, and all my limbs are light, and a hope and joy are come to me that no reason can deny. Eowyn, Eowyn, White Lady of the Rohan, in this hour I do not believe that any darkness will endure. And he stooped and kissed her brow.
And so they stood on the city walls of Gondor, and a great wind rose and blew, and their hair, raven and golden, streamed out mingling in the air, and the shadow departed, and the sun was unveiled, and light leapt forth, and the waters of Anduin shone like silver. And in all the houses of the city, men sang for the joy that welled up in their hearts from what source they could not tell. And before the sun had fallen far from the noon, out of the east there came a great eagle flying, and he bore tidings, beyond hope, from the lords of the west, crying, "Sing now, ye people of the Tower of Anor, for the realm of Sauron is ended forever, and the Dark Tower is thrown down. Sing and rejoice, ye people of the Tower Guard, for your watch hath not been in vain, and the Black Gate is broken, and your king hath passed through, and he is victorious. Sing and be glad, all ye children of the west, for your king shall come again, and he shall dwell among you all the days of your life. And the tree that was withered shall be renewed, and he shall plant it in the high places, and the city shall be blessed. Sing, all ye people." And all the people sang in all the ways of the city. All right, so starts off with Faramir and Eowyn's relationship again, but then it opens up into, like, I don't know, we can't pass up that eagle song. I mean, that's too big.
Absolutely.
But just to kind of go, like, somewhat in chronological order there, Faramir is absolutely split, right? Because, you know, this impending doom, but then this has also been an awesome week because he's gotten to know Eowyn, and he's definitely fallen in love. Like, he basically said that from right. first conversation.
Okay. Right.
And the earthquake, or, you know, all the, what was it exactly? It wasn't quite an earthquake.
It was a tremor that went through the earth, and okay, heard, so it kind of sound like a sigh.
Right. Okay. So he thought that was reminded of Numenor. Right. And so we know all about Numenor. And we know that, well, Tolkien, he had the famous, maybe you remember we talked about it, he had the wave dream where he dreamt about this huge wave. So this is reinforcing the idea that Faramir's Tolkien in the story, except Tolkien always said he's braver, you know?
Uh-huh.
But anyways, interesting connection there. But then also, like, man, Faramir thinks, like, oh, this should be our time, our Numenor. You know, it should be coming upon us now. Just like we said in, like, the last chapter, like, everybody was weeping because it was a you catastrophe, because we should all be dead right now, but we're not. So,
right.
And Faramir, to his credit, recognizes, no, we're not going to be dead. Like, this.
Yeah.
This
interestingly, it's like a few things. It's like the wave crushing Numenor actually seems very literally like this wave of darkness that we remember from the last chapters, seemingly Sauron rising up from his tower right before Frodo destroys the ring. Right.
Yeah.
That's what they're seeing from
Gondor. Well, I don't know if that was even as before he destroyed the ring, or if it was like after, and that was like his spirit kind of withering
right.
to
okay.
close
Fair
to
enough.
Nothingness. You know,
Fair enough. That's what they're seeing now.
Yeah.
But Faramir's also kind of saying that his rational prediction of what is going to happen is that there's no hope for them, that they're going to be destroyed, and it's going to be like Numenor. But his heart and his limbs and his body somehow know otherwise and feel joyous. So it's like he's got this hope, basically hope that it's better than reality could be, which feels very, like, I don't know, hope with like a big H or something.
Right.
Is where you're
the,
like,
the Estel hope that we've talked about.
Okay. Right. Right. And just to round out the Eowyn and Faramir story, it sounds like Eowyn is, it's not that she's playing dumb, but she's acting a little bit surprised that Faramir is, like, recounting his love for her, kind of. She's like, oh, what are you talking about, friend? But it seems like this moment of climax, almost, with the end of the world passing in front of their eyes, in a way, might be also a focal point for their relationship, like a turning point.
Yeah, she said she's waiting for some stroke of doom to, like, either, I don't know, help her make a choice, maybe, or tell her how to feel.
She's had this totally catastrophic outlook, and she's been supported by, or, you know, warming up to Faramir and healing along the way, but is still fundamentally assuming the world's going to end and she should be dying as a martyr. Maybe this is the moment where she's realizing, maybe I don't need to be a martyr right now, and the world isn't ending, and there's other things that I could make my life about.
Yeah. So this is like a cognitive shift.
Right.
Now, okay, yeah, my life's going to go on. It's like they're not going to drop the atomic bomb. Okay.
Right.
So, all right, but then the Eagle song. Okay, so I've been, for Lent, I've been reading the Psalms a lot. This could easily be one. And this is what basically every book said.
This sounds like more straight out of the Bible than almost any other,
right?
Any other song we've seen so far,
right? So one funny thing that I made sure to do with intention of referencing it now, but all the way back in the chapter 5 of the Fellowship of the Ring, they were at Crick Hollow and they had that stupid bath song. I made a point to say, all right, just store this one away, bookmark it somewhere, and just think about that. And then, you know, and the reason for that is like, all right, now look how far we've come. Like, look at this song. Like we've gone from goofy about
Children's story at bath time.
Right. Folk song as you can get up to the high and mightiest hymns of Middle Earth. Fleming Rutledge, she said, this canticle or psalm of deliverance seems to be directly modeled on the exultant from the liturgy of the resurrection in Christian tradition. It is properly sung at sunrise on Easter morning to herald the risen Christ. Tolkien said the resurrection was the greatest eucatastrophe possible in the greatest fairy story. And by greatest fairy story, she basically means like the true myth, which we did two whole specials about. You know, not like some fake stories. Like, no, it's a fairy story and it's a fairy tale, but it's true and it happened and it's real, right? You know, it's extremely real, which is hyper real, right?
It also made me think of like the Christmas carol, O Come All Ye Faithful, which I know is pretty basic in terms of like it repeats the same verses a lot, but like
that's my favorite Christmas carol, Clifford.
I'm not trying to insult it. It's a great Christmas carol. But like specifically like sing ye choirs of angels type thing or come all ye faithful. It sounds very similar here where it's like someone from on high addressing the faithful people, like the people of Gondor who have been fighting the good fight all along, even if they thought that it was all for naught, saying it wasn't all for naught. Like now's the time to celebrate because your king is coming back. Like, come gather and celebrate him.
Yeah.
A lot of overlap there.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So from there, joy all over the city. It immediately shifts to welcome and celebrate the king. And so, all right. So now it's instantly the happy rest of the chapter. Like now that evil's defeated, now I agree with you that this is the biggest celebration.
I'll admit, even though the last bit was kind of dark because they're thinking about the end of the world, like the Lord of the Rings equivalent of the atomic bomb going off, I think the focus of the chapter is still like the building love between Eowyn and Faramir, and this is now
and we don't have the suspense because we already know the Gurgur is already celebrated. Like all together, you know.
But yeah, totally agreed. Now is the time for full exaltation.
Right. And this is also when the big evil's defeated, this totally turns into an episode straight out of Downton Abbey. I mean, this is courtship drama, preparations for a very high, proper celebration. Oh my gosh, I'm sure I'm playing the theme song at this moment.
Awesome.
Yeah, all right. So Faramir's totally healed up, and he leaves the hospital, and he's instantly busy getting everything ready for the guy that's going to replace him. Noble Faramir. He's awesome. Okay. So Merry summoned to Ithilien. Éomer also summons Éowyn to Ithilien, but Éowyn declines, which surprises Faramir. But Eowyn's condition then starts declining when he leaves the hospital to go do the steward duties to, you know, get the city all dolled up for the king's arrival, right? And the doctor tells Faramir that he's worried about Eowyn again. And then if you watch just 15 minutes of Downton Abbey, I swear to God, this conversation could be straight in there. Nobody with a straight face can deny this. Okay, just 15 minutes. Watch that show. So we're going to jump into it, and then, tell me I'm right. Okay.
Okay.
That, yeah, you start it.
Then Faramir came and sought her, and once more they stood on the walls together. And he said to her, Eowyn, why do you tarry here, and do not go to the rejoicing in Cormallen beyond Cair Andros, where your brother awaits you?
And she said, do you not know?
But he answered, two reasons there may be, but which is true I do not know.
And she said, I do not wish to play at riddles. Speak plainer.
Then if you will have it so, lady, he said, you do not go because only your brother called for you, and to look on the Lord Aragorn, Elendil's heir, in his triumph would now bring you no joy. Or because I do not go, and you desire still to be near me. And maybe for both these reasons, and you yourself cannot choose between them. Eowyn, do you not love me, or will you not?
I wish to be loved by another, she answered, but I desire no man's pity.
That I know, he said. You desire to have the love of Lord Aragorn. Because he was high and puissant, you wish to have renown and glory and to be lifted far above the mean things that crawl on the earth. And as a great captain may to a young soldier, he seemed to you admirable. For so he is, a lord among men, the greatest that now is. But when he gave you only understanding and pity, then you desired to have nothing unless a brave death in battle. Look at me, Eowyn. And Eowyn looked at Faramir long and steadily. And Faramir said, do not scorn pity that is the gift of a gentle heart, Eowyn. But I do not offer you my pity, for you are a lady high and valiant, and have yourself won renown that shall not be forgotten. And you are a lady beautiful, I deem, beyond even the words of the elven tongue to tell. And I love you. Once I pitied your sorrow. But now, were you sorrowless, without fear or any lack, were you the blissful queen of Gondor, still I would love you. Eowyn, do you not love me?
Then the heart of Eowyn changed, or at least, at last, she understood it. And suddenly her winter passed, and the sun shone on her. I stand in Minas Anor, the Tower of the Sun, she said, and behold, the shadow has departed. I will be a shield maiden no longer, nor vie with the great riders, nor take joy in the songs of slaying. I will be a healer, and love all things that grow and are not barren. And again she looked at Faramir. No longer do I desire to be a queen, she said.
Then Faramir laughed merrily. That is well, he said, for I'm not a king. Yet I will wed with the White Lady of Rohan if it be her will. And if she will, then let us cross the river and in happier days let us dwell in fair Ithilien and there make a garden. All things will grow with joy there if the White Lady comes.
Then I must leave my own people, man of Gondor, she said. And you would have your proud folk say to you, there goes a lord who tamed a wild shield maiden of the north. Was there no woman of the race of Numenor to choose?
I would, said Faramir. And he took her in his arms and kissed her under the sunlit sky, and he cared not that they stood high upon the walls in the sight of many. And many indeed saw them in the light that shone about them as they came down from the walls and went hand in hand to the houses of Cairn.
Okay, all right. So, big question. As awesome as Faramir is he just Aragorn light? And when I say light, I mean like Coors Light. That's like a, you know, like, you know.
Light spelled L-I-T-E.
Right, yeah. That's the joke that my friends were texting recently about, like, quarterbacks. They were like, oh, this guy light. Uh-huh, and then, uh-huh. and then somebody disagreed and like, no, he's this guy zero, like Coke Zero.
I think there's one perspective, and you could say, like, a cynical take on this is Faramir's like, hey, Eowyn, you know, I know you love Aragorn, but a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, and I'm in love with you now. You could marry me now, or you could always just be longing after Aragorn, and Eowyn has a practical streak, and she's like, you know what, that actually makes a lot of sense, and goes for Aragorn light. But I think it's that's a pretty harsh take on Faramir.
Right.
It seems like it's I would peg it more as what we were talking about a little bit before this. Like, Eowyn has kind of already come around to loving Faramir. She just hasn't fully acknowledged it to herself yet.
Right. There's the line that says it. Then the heart of Eowyn changed, or else at least she understood it. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. It's like, all right, that's what you're saying. Yeah. So I kind of think. Faramir is Aragorn organic. this is, you know, Eowyn had a crush on Aragorn, who's probably like the best man in Middle Earth or whatever, but she didn't really know him. I mean, she interacted with him.
She had a crush on the idea of Aragorn or something.
Right. Whereas Faramir, okay, I just spent a week getting to know this guy. He is, you know, very noble, you know, in the same kind of echelons as that, but I actually you know, this one I know, and this, right. I don't know, like personally, right? I actually have a relationship with this guy.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's also, it's like a realignment of her values in life, right? Like she kind of acknowledges, maybe I fell in love with Aragorn because I was thinking I wanted to be a queen one day. And maybe I don't actually care about that much.
Yeah, it's also kind of interesting. She seems to renounce the warrior spirit, the shield maiden spirit a little bit.
Right.
Pretty quick there. Which, I don't know. I think like I think I've heard maybe that depresses some people. But then again, it's like, well, no, I don't know. Because we already just said, Faramir's universally beloved because he is so peaceful. Okay, so it's like, why would you like that in the one guy in this relationship but not the other, you know?
Right. Right. Or she's taking on some of Faramir's attitude where like fighting is only there to fight evil, and now that evil's been defeated,
right,
there's no reason to be
there's no reason
a fighter for anymore.
Right, definitely not. Yeah. Okay, it's not like she needs to go seek out dangerous battle adventures this. That would be bad. Well, I don't know about bad, but I would not like that myself, but for her character. But yeah, do we have anything else to say on that? Because I don't know, there's like the other critique that everybody has is like, all right, was there enough romance in Lord of the Rings? No. And Tolkien even said like Aragorn and Arwen's story was really needed to be in there, but there's no way to put it in there, right? And so we try to do a special at least, you know, so Lord of the Rings might be missing out at like a big romance somewhere towards the middle of it. But I was thinking about it, and it's just, first of all, I thought, okay, you know, Tolkien, to get personal experiences, it's like, all right, this is kind of like a bit of a war book, you know, at the end of it. I mean, I don't know, it's not like it's super bloody battle and everything, but I mean, yeah, Return of the King, especially. That was book five. That was a war book, right? Yeah, yeah. That was like all culminating in the Battle of the Age, and then they have to go do a second one at the Black Gate, you know? So, Tolkien himself, I mean, you know, when he was at war, how many women did he see or interact with? I mean, he maybe got letters and stuff, and Aragorn got treasures, I guess, from Arwen. Like, she made the banner for him and sent his love, or sent her love or whatever, but, you know. What are you going to do, especially since, too, the bulk of this adventure only took 3 months from Christmas to Easter? You know, like, Two Towers is, that whole book is, like, 2 weeks max, you know? So, I mean, like, how are you going to fit any sort of decent love story in there at this time, you know? That would be my defense of this. Because, I mean, I don't know, like, he tried his best here, you know, at the peripheries, like, before and after war, and, I don't know, he got decently believable romance in about a week, you know? Actually, it's a couple weeks because they got to prepare. This is after the ring's been destroyed for a couple weeks. But yeah, I don't know, what do you think?
Yeah, I think I agree with all of your points in defense of why there's not a larger romance woven into the story, but I think I'm still wistful that oh, nice.
Yeah, we got the gift from Zoom.
Okay. I think I am still a little bit wistful that now, you know, this romance is now, in my opinion, quite a bit more developed in the story than Aragorn and Arwen, which we would assume, we would think of as being a more important, bigger deal romance, because it's these bigger deal characters.
Well, hold on. What about how these two are more relatable, because they're both like, closer to earth humans. I mean, Aragorn's that archetypal king way up there, high in the sky.
Yeah,
he's marrying an elf.
Making, like,
elf royalty.
That's very true. It's very true. And if we're thinking of like when we were talking an episode or two or a little while back about Jesus, priest, king, healer, like the roles being fulfilled by Frodo, Gandalf, and Aragorn. I don't really think of Jesus as being like a romantic character in the same way, you know? It's like different type of love.
Yeah, you got to get really theological to think of that, because he marries the church, but...
Okay. point being, this type of like lighthearted love story doesn't totally pair smoothly with that. You know, it's like the stakes are so much bigger and about different things.
Right.
So that's a good point. It's like maybe Aragorn has jumped into an echelon of like less relatability now, where Faramir and Eowyn can fulfill that.
Yeah. And I guess if you're missing out on the romance part, I mean, I don't know. this story can't do everything. Sorry. Like, I mean, there's other stuff available. You can go read the Silmarillion. Or you could write it. You know, you could write some. Not fan fiction. Make your own story. But, I mean, you know, you could make it. But also, and what you're saying, Silmarillion. Brynn and Lúthien, I think, did have it, I would say. Like, that was a fun one. Mm-hmm. But yeah, all right. Oh, also the funniest part was, oh, he kissed her in front where many people could see her.
Because probably also Downton Abbey.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, and all the coronation stuff that we're about to get into, such a Downton Abbey feel. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. All right, with that, should we jump into it? We're going to do a play-by-play of this coronation. So I kind of tried to tell you where I'm going to break a little bit, but why don't we just go for it? Interrupt whenever you want. I'm sure I'm going to. Sorry if I'm rude in advance. If you want a clean read-through of this, you got to do it yourself, because we are going to be skipping, or we're going to be stopping probably 20 times. All right. So anyways, the city refills, all the women and children come out of hiding from the hills, right? There's flowers, musicians, fanfare, you know, it's awesome, read it, but we're going to try to somewhat streamline this, right?
And it's more than just the city of Gondor, right, Minas Tirith. This is the land of Gondor, the giant kingdom. People are flooding in from all the distant reaches.
Like Dol Amroth even, you know. Maybe it's, potentially even from outside of Gondor. Who really knows? But anyways, I guess this is their coronation, so maybe it's just limited to them. But anyways. They said, finally the last day came that the steward's banner would fly over the city, and now it is time to finally fulfill the title of this book. Let's get into it. All right. Now the captains of the West led their hosts towards the city, and folk saw them advance in line upon line, flashing and glinting in the sunrise and rippling like silver. And so they came before the gate and halted a furlong from the walls, and yet no gate had been set up again. But a barrier was laid across the entrance to the city, and there stood men at arms in silver and black with long swords drawn. Before the barrier stood Faramir the steward, and Húrin, Warden of the Keys, and other captains of Gondor, and the Lady Eowyn of Rohan, and with Elfhelm the Marshal, and many knights of the Mark. And upon either side of the gate was a great press of fair people in raiment of many colors and garlands of flower.
So now there was a wide space before the walls of Minas Tirith, and it was hemmed in upon all sides by the knights and the soldiers of Gondor and of Rohan, and by the people of the city and of all parts of the land. A hush fell upon all, as out from the host stepped the Dunedain in silver and gray. And before them came walking slow the Lord Aragorn. He was clad in black mail, girt in silver, and he wore a long mantle of pure white, clasped at the throat with a great jewel of green that shone from afar. But his head was bare, save for a star that upon his forehead bound by a slender fillet of silver. With him were Éomer of Rohan and the Prince Imrahil and Gandalf, robed all in white, and four small figures that many men marveled to see.
"Nay, cousin, they are not boys," said Irareth to her kinswomen from Imalith Melui, who stood beside her. "Those are Parian, out of the far country of the halflings, where are princes of great fame, it is said. I should know, for I had one to tend in the houses. They are small, but they are valiant. Why, cousin, one of them went with only his squire into the black country and fought with the Dark Lord all by himself and set fire to his tower, if you can believe it. At least that is the tale in the city. That will be the one that walks with our Elfstone. They are dear friends, I hear. Now he is a marvel, the Lord Elfstone. Not too soft in his speech, mind you, but he has a golden heart, as the saying is, and he has the hands of healing. The hands of the king are the hands of a healer, I said, and that is how it was all discovered. And Mithrandir said to me, 'Irareth, men will long remember your words, and—' But Irareth was not permitted to continue with the instruction of her kinswoman from the far country, for a single trumpet rang." All right, so I want to stop there. This is giving us perspective into the common folk. I actually thought it was funny, even though I find this Irareth lady annoying.
Well, yeah, I think that's the point, is that she's some comic relief of being just a gossipy woman inserting herself into the story in a sort of comical way, playing up her own role in this grand tale. And it also personalizes this crowd, right? Like, you can envision all these people from distant lands gathered around, kind of knowing that there's what's going on, but also some rumors flying around, and
yeah,
nobody has a full picture of what happened besides like the army itself, maybe.
Yeah, Fleming Rutledge, she put in, Tolkien, the master of ancient saga, is showing us how events develop into lore and finally into epic. The process of embellishment is already underway. You know, because it's like, oh, he went with only a squire and defeated the Black Lord. Right, okay.
Right,
it's like,
right.
It's not like Frodo had a sword fight with Sauron.
Right.
How that happened. But yeah, they don't know the full story yet. Because, well, and just to reiterate, because I don't know, I think I got one other point to talk. Oh no, I should have done it at the Yule song, whatever. Anyways, remember Lord of the Rings is kind of written like 200 years after the events, I think, based on firsthand texts of from the eyewitnesses and the people that lived through it, but then also a scribe kind of edited that and probably added, I don't know, like a bunch of lore details to it, I would guess, you know, like that's how you're kind of supposed to interpret this. So yeah. Also, they chose the name Elfstone for him. Remember, they only chose it because Aragorn wore the green stone when he healed everybody in the city. You know, it was on his chest. It's like putting your name on your chest. And it's like, okay, yeah. I mean, if I write Patrick on my chest, people will call me Patrick if they don't know my name. Okay. So, yeah. All right. Let's keep going with it, though. Okay, the trumpet rang, and dead silence followed. Then forth from the gate went Faramir with Hurin in the keys, and no others, save that behind them walked four men in the high helms and armor of the citadel, and they bore a great casket of black lebethorn bound with silver. Okay, so the other thing I was wondering...
What's lebethorn?
I don't really know. I think it's just a cool...
Wood or something?
Yeah, I was going to guess wood or... Well, I want to say leather, but I don't know. Well, great casket. Casket, is this, that's not, oh, I know what this is. This is the king's body. Okay. Yeah, this is the king. This is the, this is where they're going to get the crown from. Okay. Yeah. Let's assume it's lebethorn, like Lebanon, the cedars of Lebanon, you know?
Right. That's what I kept coming back to.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't even catch that. Anyways, what I was kind of wondering was like, have Aragorn and Faramir like sent choreographers, you know, to to figure out how to do this? Like, because I asked this because, you know, one of the highest functions that you still have today are like a bishop or a cardinal or a pope saying mass and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And there's definitely a guy, you can see him too. Like, they're pretty open about it. There's like a priest on the side that's like the master of ceremonies who's like, you know, making sure everything gets done in order, and even the actual head is 100% reliant on this guy. So like, do they have people like meet and talk it over, or is this, I don't know, I assume they had,
well, I mean, I think that's it's kind of interesting to reflect on, like, what's the meaning of something like this? Like, it has ritual significance to the people, but it's inherently a performance, right? Like, if it's just a practical matter of Aragorn showing up and getting a crown put on his head, you could just do that. It doesn't need all the fanfare, but the performative aspect is kind of part of the ritual significance for people. Like, it's it carries all this cultural weight for them.
Look at English people today.
But that choreography is like, it's easy to be like, oh, you know, that's kind of funny or goofy that they would have to go through the motions, but it's kind of like the going through the motions part is actually really important for the event to have the right significance for everyone and for it to feel the right way to you know.
Yeah, and it's fun.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right, so Faramir met Aragorn in the midst of those assembled there, and he knelt and said, what did he say?
The last steward of Gondor begs leave to surrender his office. And he held out a white rod, but Aragorn took the rod and gave it back, saying,
that office is not ended, and it shall be thine and thy heirs as long as my line shall last. Do now thy office.
Then Faramir stood up and spoke in a clear voice. Men of Gondor, hear now the steward of this realm. Behold, one has come to claim the kingship at last. Here is Aragorn, son of Arathorn, chieftain of the Dunedain of Arnor, captain of the host of the west, bearer of the star of the north, wielder of the sword reforged, victorious in battle, whose hands bring healing, the Elfstone, Elisar of the Lan Valandiel, Isildur's son, Elendil, son of Numenor. Shall he be king and enter into the city and dwell there?
And all the hosts and all the people cried, yea, with one voice. All right. Interesting. Well, first of all, satisfying to hear all the titles and
Yeah, that's a great epithet lead-in.
Yeah,
it's a pretty long one. I haven't heard one that long in a while.
All right, so if you want to look at the longest one in the history, in real history, look up, you don't have to do it right now, but the viewers can do this. Look up Charles V's Wikipedia, and I mean, it's an insane paragraph. He ruled everything in Europe. Like, it all inherited to him because he was the Holy Roman Emperor, uh-huh. and he was the King of Spain, and then they owned basically everything except France itself and England itself. But he had, like, territories in the New World, like California was potentially under his rule at that point. It's crazy. And he might have even still had like crusader titles from King of Jerusalem, even though Christians didn't own that anymore. Uh-huh. But like, yeah, Charles V, that's the craziest block of long titles you're ever gonna see. These ones are more Valiant and Brave from Aragorn,
which
is what I like. These are more like what you'd say about a great sportsman almost, you know, as opposed mm-hmm. to a property ruler.
right. Yeah, a lot of these are like relate to things that he's done more so than land that he owns or controls.
Yeah. Also, interesting that Faramir gives the people a choice. Like, all right, do you want him to be the king and enter into the city?
Yeah, I really like that. It's kind of like I'm reading actually this long history book right now. And apparently there's some evidence that like the first cities, even when there were monarchies emerging, that there was still some element of like local democracy coexisting with monarchy. Like people had some, like kings might have some amount of like dominant monarchical power, but not absolute power. And they still had to bend to the will of the people who could kind of reject them if they saw fit, which is pretty interesting.
Well, like Jordan Peterson will say, like, oh, you can study chimps and, you know, the strongest chimp's not always the king because, you know, the strongest chimp could be the king and then he pisses off the second and third strongest and they just kill the biggest one, you know, because they can work together to do it. So,
right.
So, yeah, you need cooperation from everybody in there. But, yeah.
But then the other interesting part here, what do you make of Faramir's, like, the stewardship of Gondor has ended, which is kind of what we assumed, right? Because the stewards only existed to keep the seat warm while there was no king. But Aragorn is saying, it's not ended, you know, you're still going to do this thing.
Yeah, so, well, okay, so the real capacity of, you know, seat warm is done. But there was always a steward for a long time, at least, or for most of Gondor's history, that aided the king. Like in Game of Thrones talk, it's like the hand of the king. You know, like there's always one of those. So yeah, I guess Aragorn's just putting that. But whereas in Gondor, you know, you used to you chose your steward, you know, by hand, like, and that was not heretical. Or, I mean,
hereditary.
Yeah, hereditary. Sorry, I always get it confused. But that wasn't hereditary, right? So then. But now Aragorn's making that hereditary too. So, which is, I don't know. Aragorn, he's pretty linked to this family, actually, if we think about the specials. So, cause like travel with Boromir, you know, he was the last one to see him before he died. Now he's friends with his brother. He didn't get along well with the dad, but he did his best to get along with the dad when he was in disguise as that Throngil guy. And he definitely liked the grandpa cause he was like the grandpa promoted him. As you know, to like basically second in command of his realm, even though he didn't even know where he was from, you know. So
right.
So I don't know. He's got quite the connection to these people, and that line has been keeping his seat warm, you know. So it's like I don't know. It's not like I dislike these guys. But yeah.
Right, and it's also we talked a while back about like the relative descendants of Numenor and how much it's the line has kind of mingled or diffused as it's moved into Middle Earth, and it seemed from what we're hearing that the line of Denethor, Boromir, Faramir was sort of very, very strongly Numenorian, which makes them like genealogically closer to Aragorn and the line of the Dúnedain, right?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Let's keep going. Eorath has another line. Do we have to read this one?
No, basically she continues to insert herself into the story, create lore in real time.
Right.
It's entertaining. But.
So Faramir spoke again, men of Gondor.
Men of Gondor, the lore masters tell that it was the custom of old that the king should receive the crown from his father ere he died, or if that might not be, that he should go alone and take it from the hands of his father in the tomb where he was laid. But since things must now be done otherwise, using the authority of the steward, I have today brought hither from Rathdinin the crown of Aranor, the last king, whose days passed in the time of our long fathers of old.
Okay, so Ianar, he was, I believe he was the last king, and he went into Minas Morgul to go to single combat with the Lord of the Ring race, except they just fooled him because he was kind of a hothead. And so they just fooled him and basically tortured him to death and killed him. But he conveniently, he left the crown in the tombs before he went over there. Okay, so that's that. So that's how they still have the crown here. Yeah, okay. And so now we're really getting to the crowning part. And right before we read it, because maybe this part we'll take in one shot and then just talk about it after, to continue the British aristocracy theme, I watched the first season of The Crown a couple years back. Best moment of it by far was when she got crowned, like Queen Elizabeth, like, you know, her coronation. Because they played this awesome song, which I guess is the coronation hymn for the English crown. So it's called Zadok the Priest. And Zadok the Priest was the priest around, the high priest around when David, King David, was crowned. And so that's where they get the name. But anyways, it's pretty awesome hymn. Yeah, it's not really a song. It's a hymn, coronation hymn. And hopefully I start clipping that in somewhere here to make this reading of it epic. English crown, too, while we're on it. Remember, Tolkien, Catholic. Probably at some point he was hopeful that the rightful Jacobite Catholic British king would someday rule again. Hopefully we mentioned it. I can't remember if we mentioned it around the Pelennor, but, you know, King Arthur was supposed to return in the darkest hour. Aragorn kind of embodied that when he came out of the ships. And now they get the fun part where he's come out of, like, the east where total victory has been won. And so, yeah, now we get the crowning part of that. So just think of all these kings returning. You know, that's definitely obviously supposed to be going on. Because, I mean, at the top of every page, it says the return of the king, you know. So let's get them all and let's name them all as we keep going. All right. But anyways, let's read this here. So the guard stepped forward and Faramir opened the casket and he held up an ancient crown. It was shaped like the helms of the guards of the citadel, save that it was loftier and it was all white. And the wings at either side were wrought of pearl and silver in the likeness of wings of a seabird. For it was the emblem of the kings who came over the sea, and seven gems of adamant were set in the circlet, and upon its summit was set a single jewel, the light of which went up like a flame. Then Aragorn took the crown and held it up and said, Et Iarlo en Dornan Utilian, Simoni Harmuvan ar Hildarnion ten Ambar Meta. And those were the words that Elendil spoke when he came up out of the sea on the wings of the wind. Out of the great sea of Middle-earth I am come. In this place I will abide, and my heirs, unto the ending of the world.
Then, to the wonder of many, Aragorn did not put the crown upon his head, but gave it back to Faramir, and said,
By the labor and valor of many I have come into my inheritance. In token of this I would have the ring-bearer bring the crown to me, and let Mithrandir set it upon my head, if he will. For he has been the mover of all that has been accomplished, and this is his victory.
Then Frodo came forward and took the crown from Faramir, and bore it to Gandalf, and Aragorn knelt, and Gandalf set the white crown upon his head, and said, Now come the days of the king, and may they be blessed while the thrones of the Valar endure.
But when Aragorn arose, all that beheld him gazed in silence, for it seemed to them that he was revealed to them for now the first time. Tall as the sea kings of old, he stood above all that were near. Ancient of days he seemed, and yet in the flower of manhood. And wisdom sat upon his brow, and strength and healing were in his hands, and a light was about him. And Faramir cried,
Behold the king!
And in that moment all the trumpets were blown, and the king Elaesiar went forth and came to the barrier. And Hurin of the Keys thrust it back, and amid the music of harp and of viol and of flute and the singing of clear voices, the king passed through the flower-laden streets and came to the citadel and entered in, and the banner of the tree and the stars was unfurled upon the topmost tower, and the reign of King Elaesiar began, of which many songs have told. Ho, ho, ho. All right. So, feelings, thoughts, was this everything you expected in a coronation? You, a 21st century American male.
I think so. I think so. The only thing that I might comment on or be curious about is that why it happens outside the city, but not.
Oh, in come kind on, of the Clifford! You know
thing, but it kind of makes sense that he's got to be like the king walks into the city, right? Like he has to be the king before he enters.
We already did this. He couldn't enter before, so he had to enter in secret. Right. Remember when he healed everybody?
Right.
Yeah, okay. Like he's
that makes
that's,
sense.
Right, like the movie does choose to do it at the top, and it's like, all right, I guess that's prettier. But this is more, you know, you're talking about symbolic stuff. It's like, all right,
right.
This is, I mean, that's, I don't know, probably highest of importance. But yeah, that did actually, you're right, though, that caught me off guard the first time I ever read it. But then it's like,
yeah, like they're doing it basically in a field, right?
Yeah.
Outside the front door. But yeah, it makes sense. It's like his kingship has to be grounded before it begins.
Yeah. Okay, so let's see.
Was it everything you hoped for for a coronation?
Yeah, I think so. It's kind of lost to history. I've read this too many times. But I remember like a couple times it's just, man, this just, I just imagine reading this that, man, this just must be the bluest sky of all time, not a cloud in the sky. You know, like there's nothing, this is just a perfect day, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think like in past rereads, you know, like I would just do kind of like one chunk each day or whatever, so this would be the end of a chunk, and it's just, man, I'm in a good mood. Like, mm-hmm. Like the rest of the day I'm in a good mood, that can't be beat.
Anyways,
let's get into like the actual I guess the symbolism itself of the crowning and or mm-hmm. the dynamics of it. So Aragorn wants Gandalf to put it onto him after Frodo gives it to Gandalf, so the ring bearer is now becoming, well, bearer again, but this time it's just the crown, and it's not. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have to go to Mordor again. It's just, you know, symbolic gesture there, right? But anyways, We're getting the priest, prophet, king coming together in that moment, I would say. That's highly significant. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then Gandalf's going to put the crown on him. So what this does not remind you of is famously Napoleon crowned himself emperor, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so he had some, I think he had somebody actually pass him the crown, but he put on the crown himself. So I don't know a ton about Napoleon, but that's one of the reasons I don't like him, all right?
Yeah.
Maybe I could, like, just go into that more, research that more, and come to a fuller conclusion, but that's definitely going to be my bias going in when I do. So
I mean, it fits with everything. I'm not an expert either, but from everything I've heard and read about his personality.
Yeah, his big ego. Disposition. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Now, versus Gandalf crying Aragorn, if we want to get real medieval, what this is totally going to sound like is the Pope crowning Charlemagne, the Holy Roman Emperor. Okay, and so I think that's kind of a controversial, murky topic, how, I don't know, how much of an ego Charlemagne had. He probably had a big one too, you know, but he did, and I don't know, there's some sort of controversy that I haven't gotten into yet about the crowning, like whether he wanted it or not, but anyways, I don't know. I've also heard accounts where Charlemagne was a very faithful man, so maybe he would be totally cool with the Pope crowning him.
Mm-hmm. I feel like even apart from the specific example of Charlemagne, like what's interesting about that is like the idea of a priest or pope crowning the king implies that like the power of the crown is being given to a king, but it's vested in something else. Like the power is stemming from the religion,
yeah,
for instance. And that power, because it's religion, is coming from God. So it's like this like sequence of like where the authority and legitimacy and power of one thing is coming from. And so it's like the power of the kingdom is rooted in the religion, is rooted in God. And so it's like there, you know, or you could make it a circle maybe of like God is rooted in the faith of the people, which, and then the religion is rooted or something in that, like,
yeah,
depending on how sickly you want to make it. But the point being, whoever is giving the crown implies like that's a source of legitimacy and authority. So it's like, same thing with like Faramir asking the people of Gondor if they approve of Aragorn walking into the city. It's like giving the people's legitimacy to Aragorn. Same thing here. It's like Aragorn's recognizing that like some of his power and legitimacy is coming by way of Gandalf and by way of Frodo.
Right. And the reference to Charlemagne, Joseph Pierce points out, he says, as a true king, Charlemagne unites all the peoples of Christendom when he was Holy Roman Emperor. Because, he ruled, like, all of Western Europe, basically, at that point. Or it all answered to him. Just as Aragorn unites all the free peoples of Middle Earth. Okay, so that's, like, we didn't actually talk about that one returning because Charlemagne never really returned. So, anyways, this is the first time we're mentioning him. But, like, you're thinking of the Jacobites, you're thinking of King Arthur, you're thinking of Charlemagne. Obviously, we're going to get to the biggest return of the king in, like, 1 second. But, yeah, just there's that one as well. Mithrandir will set it upon my head, if he will, so Gandalf has the choice to do it, for he's been the mover of all that has been accomplished, and this is his victory. What'd you think of that? Because I wouldn't quite say, like, I would say Gandalf, you know, like, not to say Aragorn's wrong, like, Gandalf yeah. was the mover, but it's not like he did everything himself, or he was the,
yeah.
like, he was answering to, you know, like, the mover with a capital M, you know, like, he's just right, kind of right. In this moment, he's definitely the embodiment of divine providence from God above, you know,
like, yeah, like what exactly. you're saying,
where he's crowning it. But
I agreed. It is an interesting line. If, you know, even though Gandalf is obviously a focal character for the whole thing, he is, like, in some ways, he's not as primary of a character as Aragorn and Frodo are in a lot of ways. It's like, they're like the actors doing, doing the actions of the story. Gandalf is, like, always in the background, like, assisting or helping or nudging, like, he's, on some of those actions.
Facilitate, I think, is, like, the best right. word. But even then, it's, like, I don't know. Actually, it's kind of funny because in the one, I don't know, basically deleted scene that we're going to talk about, Gandalf talks about making mistakes, too. I mean, so mm-hmm. it's not even, like, it's not like he's totally omniscient, you know? So
right
he's kind of just he's gotten this done by the skin of his teeth too, just like everybody else, even though he was the commander-in-chief though, so I guess I kind of get it. Mm-hmm. I also thought this is kind of like the father God crowning the son Jesus, and then right. I guess you say maybe Frodo is somehow like the Holy Spirit in between them, you know, I don't know, but like right, priest right. prophet okay. king Trinity, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. There's something working there, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Regardless, though, it does feel like, yeah, Gandalf is maybe a stand-in for everything. He represents more than just Gandalf in this moment. He's right. kind of tied to the Valar more broadly.
Yeah. Who he referenced there, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, it's another way of Aragorn saying maybe, like, I will take this crown from the gods if they accept me, type thing.
Yeah, yeah. All right, and then, yeah, obviously this ushers in the new golden age. It's the new benchmark of what everything's going to be compared to. But, oh, let's read that last paragraph. Let me do it. Okay. All right, actually, do you want to take that sure. last paragraph just to finish this off? Yeah.
It is time the city was made more fair than it had ever been, even in the days of its first glory. It was filled with trees and with fountains, and its gates were wrought of mithril and steel, and its streets were paved with white marble. And the folk of the mountain labored in it, and the folk of the wood rejoiced to come there. And all was healed and made good, and the houses were filled with men and women and the laughter of children. And no window was blind, nor any courtyard empty. And after the ending of the third age of the world into the new age, it preserved the memory and the glory of the years that were gone.
Okay. So the last line of that, new golden age preserves what was somewhat too, but I don't know. They're still temporally in this world.
Right.
Even this golden age is going to fade too, you know, like, so mm-hmm. this coronation, like, as much as it sounded, literally heavenly, you know, yeah. or it's just a prefigurement of it. It's not actually, you know, like,
it's not terminal.
Yeah. It's not the real thing. It's not the real everlasting thing yet, you know,
mm-hmm.
but this is the good eucatastrophe, the signposts for what's to come. So I don't know, right. pretty cool, but yeah, still keep it a little bit grounded. There's a bunch of parts where, and we don't really have too much time to go into it, where the king's setting everything right. You know, he's pardoning Easterlings, receiving gifts. He's being buds with Éomer. The only thing I do want to mention is the parting of Beregond for mm-hmm. killing two of the fellow tower guards to protect Faramir. I mean, it's just the most suspenseful backwards thing.
right.
It's presented in the most, yeah, it's ridiculous. Of Aragorn
is pretty much like, you should be sentenced to death for what you did, but because I'm benevolent, I'm going to go send you away to Ithilien.
It's even worse than that. It's, you know, instead of the death penalty for your actions, which is what they would typically warrant, nice job. But you're going to have to be exiled from Minas Tirith.
Oh, no.
To Sir Faramir as the Prince of Ithilien. And you're only going to have to go across the river, and you'll still be inside of Minas Tirith. You know,
I mean, right, it's
like,
right.
It was just like, oh my gosh, Aragorn, you're my favorite character, but you can't leave a guy in that much suspense.
I know.
And that, I don't know. Okay, so that one was Fleming Rutledge's book. She said, like, oh, that's supposed to be like Wise King Solomon in the Golden Age of Israel. It could just be any good king, I think, you want to insert. And then Christ the King, justice and mercy, order and repentance, you know, it's all available there. And then to your point about divinity, like, proclaiming the king, you know, two quotes for that. Rutledge says, benevolent earthly rule derives from his rule in heaven. That is why justice and mercy are paramount qualities of a true biblical king. So like, you know, any king derives his rule from, the heavenly king, Christ the king, right? And then Joseph Pierce also adds, kingship itself is only legitimate insofar as it holds its authority from God. All true kings are only true insofar as they reflect the true kingship of Christ. All lesser images, such as Aragorn's connection to Charlemagne, Arthur, or the Jacobite kings in exile, fall into the shadow in the presence of Christ's kingship, which Aragorn's kingship reflects. In this ultimate and highest sense of kingship, the return of the king signifies the second coming, when the long defeat of history will be vanquished by the final victory of Christ. This is the ultimate return from exile of the true king to claim his own. I feel like that one summed it up pretty well. Okay, so, but the chapter's not done yet. Not done. All the guests end up leaving the city, including Eowyn and Éomer, who go clean things up in Rohan, right? But they're going to come back for Théoden's body. For some reason, they didn't feel like taking him that time. But whatever. Yeah. They need a procession with that, too. But anyways, Théoden's body is... They must be mummifying it at this point. All right, about a month passes since the coronation. And then I thought it was interesting that Aragorn says... He was loth for the fellowship to be dissolved yet, okay?
Yeah.
Interesting word, loth, and I want to try to come back to it in a couple episodes or something. I have an idea how to do it. Okay. So Gandalf, the hobbits, Legolas, and Gimli, they're all just hanging out. Frodo's happy, but, you know, he doesn't even, like he doesn't really even know why he's still here. And he does actually finally think, like, maybe I want to go back to the Shire about now. And I definitely want to see Bilbo, too. And then it's when Gandalf drops a bomb on anybody that hasn't been paying close attention as they read the whole book. Like, it hasn't even been a year since you left Bag End, you know? It's like, and then you're just saying, what? like if you weren't listening to this, you might not have remembered that they left in late December. I mean, maybe you remember, like, they got to Rivendell in October. Maybe you remember that because they set out in the fall. But he's like, it's just May right now. And it's like, what?
Right, like, yeah, if you weren't paying attention to dates, you feel like it's easy to assume Lord of the Rings is, like, a couple years long.
Well, I mean, emotionally it has been, too. I mean, that's the whole thing.
Right, right, right.
You know, Frodo and Sam departed the Fellowship and then destroyed the ring a month later, but it's like, that was more than a month. I mean, they were in a different Einstein relativity, stuff going on at that point. Anyways, Gandalf hints that, like, don't worry about Bilbo. He knows what Aragorn's waiting for here. But they leave us hanging, and they cut to a scene where Gandalf and Aragorn, they sneak off up the slopes of Mindaluin. So that's the mountain that's, like, right, basically Minas Tirith is built on that mountain, right?
Yeah, it's
so
they built on, like, the front slope kind of, right?
So they go up it, and from the top, I think they both got good eyes as well in addition to this, but they can see all the way from the Rauros waterfalls where Boromir died all the way down to... close to the sea, probably to Pelargir, the watchtower where Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli got the ghost, right?
So almost all of Gandalf, or excuse me, almost all of Gondor, right?
Right. Not like the Dol Amroth part, but all the parts that we kind of know, you know, so enough of it, right? Okay, and then what does Gandalf say here? You want to start it?
This is your realm, and the heart of the greater realm that shall be. The third age of the world is ended, and the new age is begun. And it is your task to order its beginning and to preserve what may be preserved. For though much has been saved, much must now pass away. And the power of the three rings is also ended. And all the lands that you see, and those that lie around them, shall be the dwellings of men. For the time comes of the dominion of men, and the elder kindred shall fade or depart.
I know it well, dear friend, said Aragorn, but I would still have your counsel.
Not for long now, said Gandalf. The third age was my age. I was the enemy of Sauron, and my work is finished. I shall go soon. The burden must lie now upon you and your kindred.
But I shall die, said Aragorn, for I am a mortal man, and though being what I am, and of the race of the West unmingled, I shall have life far longer than other men. Yet that is but a little while, and when those who are now in the wombs of women are born and have grown old, I too shall grow old. And who then shall govern Gondor, and those who look to this city as to their queen, if my desire be not granted? The tree in the court of the fountain is still withered and barren. When shall I see a sign that it will ever be otherwise? So, all right, let's pause there. It's kind of funny. Like, I don't know how you read it. I don't actually think I read it this way, but it's kind of funny to think of it this way. Like, Gandalf saying, yep, it's time for the men, dominion of men to start, time for you guys to step up. And Aragorn's like, yeah, well, I'm glad I can count on you, Gandalf. It's like, no, you can't. I'm gone. This is it. I don't know. I didn't actually kind of read it. Like, I think Aragorn more just stoically said, like, oh yeah, but your counsel would be good. Like, I don't know, maybe he just said, like, he wasn't fully expecting Gandalf to just be like, yeah, I'm peacing out now, right?
Right.
Yeah, so, but anyways, he is, right? Okay, so this is Gandalf's swan song, or this is Gandalf's swan song now. Like, his age is over. He was part of the third age, which is what we're going to get into with this deleted scene, basically, that I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's a little bit wild. I mean, this chapter is like, there's something, it's like the time scale over the course of the chapter is almost exponential. Like, we start out at the beginning where we're like counting time and days, and now we're counting ages, which is like the scale so far beyond Lord of the Rings. It's like the entirety of the Silmarillion is the third age, right?
Right.
So it's this massive shift in how we're thinking about the story. So it's almost like it takes a second to register what Gandalf is saying, but it's almost like this entire mythology that exists in Lord of the Rings and the Silmarillion is currently wrapping up, and this is the beginning of everything else, or the beginning of what comes next. So it's super melancholy, or at least it's like very sad to hear.
Well, it's not super melancholy. All right, you know what? It's kind of like
it's celebratory, like, but it's also melancholy.
Yeah, but it's kind of like well, it's like fly in the nest, kind of. If you want to get into it too, Gandalf, Christ references and everything, this is like, all right, are we getting to like an ascension type moment where he's going to ascend up? And it's like, all right, well, that sucks. Jesus is gone. But then it's like, well, no, he's going to come in the Holy Spirit at Pentecost. And it's like, you guys have the tools. Like, and that's the thing. We're going to finish this off in a second. But it's like Gandalf, the elves, everybody, they've given Aragorn and all men the tools to like set them up for success as best they can. It's not going to go perfectly because, you know, this is a fallen world, but, you know, they did their best and they brought about a new golden age, you know, so they've done well here. They got a good start, you know, and they all did their part for out of love for them, you know, even though their time's over. And that's just kind of the way the world works, right? Everything passes away at this point.
But it's specifically that non-finality that Aragorn started in question, right? He's like, well, this clearly isn't the end, because I'm going to die and there's going to be people who come after me. Like, what happens then?
Yeah, he's worrying about, like, his heirs, and it's like, I don't know, dude. You have to be a good dad and raise your kids right and set them up for success as best you can. But it's like, I don't know, you can only do so much to a point, and then, yeah, it's kind of scary because somebody's going to screw up. So, yeah. Was interesting, too, if you're wondering. He's that interesting way to say it. It's like, all right, the kids being born now, when they die, that's when I'm gonna finally be really old and I'm probably gonna die, you know, at that point. So he's got one full lifetime left, so about 80 to 100 years left. Okay. So
yeah.
Just good to know for anybody that's wondering, I guess.
it was a small line, but when the eagle showed up at the start of, or the midpoint of the chapter.
Yeah.
There was a line like, for the king shall come again, and he shall dwell among you all the days of your life, which implies, like, if you could read that sounding like immortality, but it's actually, it's almost like a wordplay. Aragorn's living longer than all the people, the normal people who are going to be alive around him.
True.
So it's going to be like a taste of immortality in their eyes, but Aragorn is still mortal.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's keep going with this. Aragorn, he said, when shall I see a sign that it will ever be otherwise? And he's talking about the barren tree. Like,
mm-hmm. Turn your face from the green world and look where all seems barren and cold, said Gandalf.
Then Aragorn turned, and there was a stony slope behind him running down from the skirts of the snow. And as he looked, he was aware that alone there in the waste, a growing thing stood. And he climbed to it. And saw out of the very edge of the snow there sprang a sapling tree no more than 3 foot high. Already it had put forth young leaves long and shapely, dark above and silver beneath, and upon its slender crown it bore one small cluster of flowers, those white petals shone like the sunlit snow. Then Aragorn cried, Ye Atún Vinius, I have found it. Lo, here is a scion of the eldest trees. How come it here? For it is not itself yet 7 years old.
And Gandalf, coming, looked at it and said, Verily, this is a sapling of the line of Nimloth the Fair, and that was a sealing of Galathilion, the fruit of Telperion of many names, eldest of trees. Who shall say how it comes here in the appointed hour? But this is an ancient hallow, and ere the kings failed or the tree withered in the court, a fruit must have been set here. For it is said that, though the fruit of the tree comes seldom to ripeness, yet the life within may then lie sleeping through many long years, and none can foretell the time in which it will awake. Remember this, for if ever a fruit ripens, it should be planted, lest the line die out of the world. Here it has lain hidden in the mountain, even as the race of Elendil lay hidden in the wastes of the north. Yet the line of Nimloth is older far than your line, King Elisar.
Okay, so tree genealogies. That's all the way back in the Token in the Eucharist special that we did with the Scott guy. Check that out, because we talk about all the tree genealogies going back to Silmarillion times, because that's what they're talking about with Nimloth and Telperion. So yeah, that anyways, cool. So we already kind of talked about the Dominion of Men stuff. I don't know. Token, this is never going to perfectly fit, but this was always supposed to be our world, our real normal world, you know? And this is kind of, it's probably Middle Earth. This is probably somewhere to the north, beyond the edge of history, but just barely beyond it, right? And so it's like all this stuff should sound kind of familiar and it should fit together, you know? Like he was reconstructing nursery rhymes and trying to think of a mythology for England, you know, and so all of that's what he's kind of doing, and now he's prefiguring everything that's in the Bible, right? So I don't know. Anyways, he's wizard, elves are done, wizards are done, dwarves are gonna decline, ants are really close to done. You know, there's it's the Dominion of Men. This is what he's kind of been setting up, and sad to see, but that's the way it goes. I'm more interested in the tree itself, like, how did this thing get here?
Gandalf's line where he's like, turn away from the green world and look at where all seems barren and cold. In other words, like, look at the opposite of what you would expect for maybe the answer to your question about where the rest of your line is or where the future lies. And it's deliberately counterintuitive, and it made me think of like all the type of kind of inversions that you see in like a lot of biblical stuff. That's like the weak shall be made powerful type thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or like, yeah, the meek shall inherit the earth. Like those types of opposites. It seems like Gandalf is maybe referencing some of that here. Like where you thought all was lost, that's where hope is and where it blooms again. And like where everything is blooming now, it's not necessarily where you should expect it to continue to come from.
Yeah. Let me just look one thing up that I'm interested in.
Okay.
So let's get a dorky Inuit theory here.
Okay. I'm ready.
So I'm wondering, like, I was actually really like, all right, Gandalf has the line, who knows who put, like, I don't know, this is an ancient hallow, ere the kings failed or the tree withered in the court, a fruit must have been set here. So I was like, all right, maybe that's a good enough explanation. But I looked this up, and I couldn't find anything about it, so I've concluded that this must have been a Patrick Santino idea from original from like 6 or 7 years ago that I've like held on to. And then, yeah, literally I looked up everything I could about this, couldn't find it. So it's like, all right, this is my own idea. All right.
Drum roll, making some Lord of the Rings scholarship right here.
All right. So they find this sapling here and it's like, all right, yeah, maybe somebody put it here, whatever. But I don't quite believe that. Okay. So this passage started out that it said the south feet of Mount Mindoloin, and there they found a path made in ages past that few now dared to tread, for it led up to the mountain to a high hallow where only the kings had been wont to go. Okay. So again, my idea, maybe I'm wrong on this, but if you remember all the way back to our Kirion and Errol episode, they swore that oath that Elendil's... You remember Kirin and Errol are the Rohan and Gondor, right? Okay, and that's when they became friends. They did it at Elendil's grave at the Halfurion Beacon Hill. That's what it is now. Right. It's a beacon at this point. Because that's where he was buried at the time. Because at the time, that was the center of Gondor. But then it wasn't anymore. And so then what we didn't read there was... And you can find this in Unfinished Tales, but there's the line that says, "The casket, therefore, that Isildur had set within the bound, within the mound, that's Elendil's body that was in the mound, Kirion removed to the hallows of Minas Tirith, but the green mound remained as a memorial of a memorial." Okay? So, the hallows of Minas Tirith, there's that Rath Dinan place, which is where Faramir had just taken the that's where Denethor killed himself, and then that's where Faramir had taken the casket to pull out the crown to get put on Aragorn. But that translates to Silent Street. And so what I was kind of thinking was this line, "For it led up to the mountain, to the high hallow, where only the kings had been wanted to go." I was almost wondering, like, well, is Elendil buried here? And, you know, this is sprouting up from his grave right there. I don't really know.
I buy it.
Yeah.
That's, I buy it.
I don't know. I guess Gandalf could just say somebody planted it eventually and it can sprout whenever the time's right. But so I guess that's good enough. But I like my idea better. Tolkien should have consulted.
What do you make of this? There's this line, "For if ever a fruit ripens, it should be planted, lest the line die out of the world." It sounds almost like Gandalf is issuing some advice to Aragorn and also commenting on the past and the way they've done it. It's like... Dude. You can't miss this moment of like when the tree can keep growing or something. What did you make of that?
All right, on the spot, I think you could symbolically do it in two ways. You could do, all right, the line, Aragorn's line, which stretches all the way back to like Beren and Lúthien. You know, it's like Legolas had quotes in there in some of the previous chapters, like made that line never fail, and Legolas even bet that it wouldn't. Sow a seed. You know, plant a fruit, you know, so I think like continue the line, not just the physical tree line, but then also Aragorn's family line. But then I also think if we want to, again, we could keep getting biblical with all this stuff. And I think it's fair justification because there's so many parables about this, but Jesus has so many like parables, like plant the seed, you know, like good seed falls on this ground, whatever, you know? And I was just reading in Pope Benedict's Jesus of Nazareth book, like the culmination of those is, these Greek guys come up to Jesus, and so, you know, they're not Jewish, right? And so we don't know what they asked him, but what Jesus, there's theories about what they asked him, and some theories are like, hey, what are you doing staying in Jerusalem here? Like, these people are pissed at you. You're going to get yourself killed, you know? You can't, this is dangerous. Come to Athens, you know, we're the philosopher people. Like, we treat you like a philosopher king, and, you know, you'd be taken care of there. And Jesus' response to him, because this is what they had based the thoughts off of. Jesus' response to him was, "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. He who has love for life loses it, and he who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life." So, I mean, I don't know. It's like, if you have a fruit, what is Gandalf saying here exactly?
"For if ever a fruit ripens, it should be planted, lest the line die out of the world."
Yeah, so like you planting your seed is like you doing your part almost, and so it's like if you have the opportunity to do that, like it's
never that's almost miss like, the opportunity.
Yeah, it's almost like fulfill your full potential almost. You know, that's how I was kind of read that.
Okay,
And that's doing that in like a selfless way, because what Jesus is saying with the parables is like, I have to die so that I can reach my fullest potential. You know? Mm-hmm. And that's what everybody has to do too. Like, I'm the paradigm of that, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know? All right. It's probably enough of that one. this is, you know, don't you get it? Like, I think we're gonna have to break off the other thing and do it its own little special, but we'll see what I do.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, this chapter was unexpectedly overwhelming. You know, this is exactly absolutely what I'm talking about. I actually even tried to like really slim this one down, and we didn't do it, Clifford. But anyways, there was the old dead tree that was in the courtyard, and so they reverently removed that and replant this tree. And again, these trees, you know, remember all the way in the Silmarillion and the downfall of Numenor, Isildur himself had saved a fruit of the tree before Sauron destroyed it in Numenor. So it's like, this is what it's a descendant of. This has always been the symbol of Elendil's people. And I don't know. You could almost even say it's a symbol of the tree of life. Again, biblical. Check out our Token in the Eucharist special for that.
Mm-hmm. And also, maybe also like the Nordic Yggdrasil.
Oh, yeah. That one too. Yeah, right. Because I guess that's like, yeah, that's the tree of, I guess, life, like, or everything. The world. And universes.
Yeah. Definitely Tolkien likes trees.
Right, yeah.
They're important for their kind of preservation and lineage was very important to him.
Yeah. Okay, so in June, this tree starts to blossom, and Aragorn says, all right, now the day is not far off. Turns out, it's a wedding. Arwen rocks up, right? I don't know, Galadriel, Celeborn, Elrond, they all come in.
Basically, every elf we've met in Lord of the Rings shows up.
Now, luckily, Tolkien did not attempt to write both a coronation and a royal wedding in the same chapter. So it's kind of just quickly said at the end, but I don't know. What'd you think of it? Thoughts? Feelings?
It sounds like epic and beautiful, and it's almost helpful here. I think that Tolkien doesn't describe it in too much detail because it leave some of the beauty up to the imagination.
Right.
Like this procession of all of the most important elves that we know showing up all at once is like, it's hard to put words to that after we've heard all of these epic descriptors for Aragorn's coronation.
And I bet you he would have put in the wedding stuff if he could have put Arwen in the book more. But now it'd be kind of weird. Mm-hmm. Like, all right, she's just been a very background character the whole time. Like, she's had...
Right.
I don't know, two scenes in one chapter back in Rivendell. You know, that was 5 books ago, basically. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But one of the things, though, Elrond gives him the scepter of Annuminas. I'm not even going to ask you if you remember what that is, but that was the Northern King's scepter. And when we did the Aragorn special, he said he gave Aragorn the shards of Narsil and the Ring of Bar here, but he withheld the scepter because, like, you haven't earned this yet. And it's like, I don't know why this is yours to give, but... Anyways, he earned it now. And because that's the symbol of the North Kingdom, so it's like...
The North Kingdom being Arnor?
Yeah, or the North, that's fault. Okay. Like, you know, the Dunedain's kingdom in the north, because that's where he's from. So, mm-hmm. Keep tabs on that, because... keep tabs on that. I don't know.
Okay, I will.
And Arwen, Ivestar of her people, again, last hurrah, elves, Gandalf, they're all setting up men as best they can. Give another last injection of elf blood, basically, into the line, you know, to help preserve it, and hopefully they stay faithful and loyal. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyways, it was pretty awesome. This chapter, besides Downton Abbey music and Zadok the Priest, definitely reminded me of the Sleeping Beauty soundtrack. I'm totally in love with it. They just used Tchaikovsky's ballet for that movie. It's like, oh, it's so perfect. It's like, that's why I like this movie so much when I found it out. It's like, duh. It's like, I watched that movie. It's like, man, this is a good soundtrack. And then I found out, I was like, yep, they just straight took it. Yeah. But, all right. Yeah, I think this is too long to add on a deleted scene that's going to also be really long. So, I guess it's going to have to be its own special. And I got enough to, I guess, stretch it out to, well, you know. Normal, especially long special, probably. I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Okay. Thanks, y'all.